Welcome to the State of the Markets Oil Market Special. I'm Paul Rodriguez of ThinkTrading.com, joined by financial analyst Zach Mir. And our very special guest is Paul Vonk, Managing Director of Angus Energy. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello, Paul. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Paul. Hello, Zach. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome, Paul. Now, just for the benefit of the listeners, could you just tell us a little bit about Angus Energy?
Yeah, with pleasure. Now, I'm the Managing Director of Angus Energy, which is a UK company focusing really on opening up the wheeled basin in southern England, which we're really an exciting time with at the moment.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, Paul.
Myself, I started off as an engineer in the oil field back in the day, straight after university, as a wireline engineer. That is the people that take a measurement of what is down in the well after oil companies have drilled the well to see what's there, whether they've actually found oil or gas or not. Did that for a couple of years, primarily in Northern Africa, Algeria, Egypt, those type of countries, always onshore. And then after a couple of years, did an MBA, went into banking, specifically focused on oil and gas, oil and gas corporate finance, doing IPOs for oil and gas companies, doing M&A. And then in around 2013, 2014, I moved to the other side of the table, worked for oil and gas companies directly, and then got involved with Angus Energy. And around 2016, after the Horsehill well test, and that flowed, with really incredible rates for the first time onshore UK from this hybrid layer, we thought that we were really onto something special here, and then we IPO'd Angus Energy, and here we are now.
I've got a question for Paul, just to dial back a bit on what he said. You obviously did your studies, you did your exams. You could have been an investment banker just sitting in an ivory tower somewhere. Why did you decide to go for the Wild West for the oil and gas sector, which can be very binary in outcomes? Are you like a sort of an adrenaline junkie? You like risk? What's that? What's it? What is it in your character that's taking you to this particular area?
It's a fundamental industry to humanity. Let's be honest about that. And when there's two components to your question, I believe. One is, why did I move into oil and gas in the first place straight after uni? Well, I studied mining and petroleum engineering. So already at high school, I was attracted to this industry because one of the things, it's worldwide, and you had the choice when you were younger. You could travel the world with a backpack and wash dishes and wait or tables, or you could actually see the world with a paycheck. And I was like, hey, that's not a bad idea. Let's go into petroleum engineering. And when I was there, you find out it's such a great industry run by you meet such wild and interesting characters in there, and it's good. It's a fundamental piece of what makes us great at the moment. It is providing energy, and while you're doing it, it can be really exciting, because one of the companies that I worked for as a wireline engineer back in Algeria, they did a massive gas discovery. And that really changed, the outlook of the company, the financial position of everybody that invested in that company. And that was great. And I was like, hey, I should keep this in the back of my mind. I should do something about that in the future if I've actually, learned the additional skills about finance. And that happened in around 2014 and made the step to the other side.
Well, speaking of skills, the other issue which we'll obviously talk about with Angus and with the wheel basins, everything else, is that you've actually studied the subject. You're well qualified in the whole, presumably on a geological basis and all the other, complicated bases, if that's the right word, that the oil and gas sector works. And on a day-to-day basis, you are coming to blows, at least in verbally, let's say, with people who know, who obviously aren't, qualified in this area. They're just investors. They put in their 500 quid or £5,000 or £50,000 or whatever they put in. They don't have any expertise, but they're telling you what's there and what's not there. How do you feel about that?
Well, to put that into perspective, I speak the language of the technical side of the rocks and everything, but let's not underestimate the knowledge base that you really need to have. That's why at Angus Energy we have a team where people are sitting there that started out with BG, back in the 60s, that really understand the subsurface and the rocks. So you need to have a long, you know, experience before you can actually make judgments about whether the oil and gas is there. But what I'm doing, I understand their language. I hear what they're saying. And if they're confident and they're excited, it's my job to then communicate that to everybody else that didn't have the luxury of, you know, understanding that language. So it is, well, it's my job to keep make it as simple as possible. And most importantly, after we promise something that we're going to do, actually deliver. And that is indeed the project that we're doing with Angus Energy. And as we've can seen in Balcom, you know, there was a lot of skepticism beforehand. And the test results were fantastic.
Before we get on to specifics about Angus Energy, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about what onshore production is and why you do onshore production.
Onshore production is great because you can actually walk to the site. We take the train to our sites in southern England. Now, the major benefit, oil is found subsurface. Usually it's found, you know, 1,000 meters or deeper below the rocks. The UK has had a fantastic history and still does of offshore production. But offshore production is complicated. You need a very large organization. You need a lot, have a lot of personnel. Everything that you do is much more expensive than onshore. Onshore is nice in the sense that you can touch it, you can bring it there, so the logistics costs are much smaller. And what we're doing with Angus, we have these sites where they've already been drilled, you know, decades ago. So the UK has got a long history of onshore production, which is basically under the radar, people not aware of it, because you don't see the sites. And what we're doing is we're taking these old sites, we've refurbished them, we make them all compliant with all the future standards. And then what we're doing now is we're going to produce oil from a layer that's been overlooked in the past. So we can do that for a really, really low cost. I think the sidetrack of the well that we're going to switch on shortly, the Brockham well, we drilled it for about £1 million, you know, a couple hundred thousand additions to all the periphery around it. So for £1.5 million, we're looking at a very good producer in the future. And well, I don't know what the latest rates are for offshore drilling, but I'd be surprised you can do anything for less than 20 million. And that is just having a well, let alone put it into production. It's much more complicated. So it's a fraction of the cost offshore. That is the real attraction about onshore.
So for people who are unfamiliar with this process, what's the difference between what you're doing and fracking, for example?
Well, fracking is the method that has been hugely successful, primarily in America, where people have drilled a well, you know, using a conventional drilling rig and a drill bit, and they put, you know, huge amount of fluids with sand in it to basically break the rock, fracture the rock, have sand in it. So they call it proppants to keep those fractures that you've created by putting huge amount of pressures in the well to keep them open, and that way release the gas and the oil that is embedded in that shale, that it's actually in there. And with the fracture, you keep it open, which is a technology that we don't have to deploy in our assets at all, because what we're looking at in southern England, the Weald Basin, that is a fractured reservoir. The nature has already fractured for us over millions of years. So the only thing that we're doing is we're drilling a conventional well, as people have been drilling for the last hundred years. And when we drill that well, we go through the fractures that are already there, and then we open a tap, basically on surface, and it flows naturally. So we don't have to do any fractures. We don't have to invade the rock. We don't have to break the rock. It just flows naturally.
Yeah, I just wanted to get on to, I mean, obviously it's one of those issues where people, you might say, I'm not my brother's keeper, but you are the resident oil expert amongst the three of us at the moment. With UK oil and gas, there was an announcement yesterday, which if you read it, it seems to be quite positive. But according to some commentators, it's a complete sort of disaster. What's the reality of UKOG in your mind, or from your opinion, Paul?
Well, we've been following, you know, their activity closely, because we're talking here about the Horsehill well, which is a carbon copy of our Brockham field, which is about 5-6 miles to the west. Angus Energy was the company that originally drilled the Horsehill well. And then when the flow test results came out in 2016, we're like, hey, the only reason why it flowed that much was that we're dealing with a fractured reservoir because the rock itself is too tight. We didn't have a lot of money at the time. We had a bad capital structure. So we sold out of Horsehill because we have a 65% interest in the Brockham field, which has a production license, which is very important, you know, 7 miles next door. So we thought, you know, looking at this basin, we're not looking at a structural trap. That's in the old days. You know, you find a pocket of oil, and then, you know, you're really happy if you're that oil company because you've got that pocket of oil and you can suck it dry, and then and you've made a lot of money. In this case, if we're dealing with an hybrid reservoir, and I think that's it's quite important for people to understand, is that a hybrid reservoir is the same as in America what you would call an unconventional reservoir. It means that this horizontal layer that's under the ground, you can get oil from everywhere. Doesn't matter where you are. You can drill a hole and the same results will come out of it because the geology is the same. We're not looking for a trap. Unconventional means it's everywhere.
So you're also implying that, you know, Brockham is better than Horse Hill. Is that correct?
Well, no, that's never what we said. What we said is we think it's the same geology. It's the same carbon copy. Now, yeah. What happened is that the well, the Horse Hill well, was never drilled as a Kimmeridge producer. And they're accessing two Kimmeridge layers. That is the limestone layers that we originally accessed when we perforated. So they've just announced results for KL3. And they're now going to the layer above it, they called KL4. What we think is that Kimmeridge layer, which is about 400 meters thick at Horse Hill and about 400 meters thick at Brockham, we believe there's a 200 meter natural fractured layer in there, and it's all the same reservoir. It's literally the same oil column. So our idea is, why perforate a single layer of limestone and then another single layer? Why don't you just perforate the whole 200 meter section and flow from it, and for future wells, see which layers are most productive. So we don't think it's better. We think that the sidetrack that we've drilled at Brockham is able to access a much larger portion of the Kimmeridge than they've been able to do at Horse Hill.
So like they say, it's easier rather than better.
Correct.
The other point is obviously the market was slightly disappointed with UK oil and gas yesterday. I mean, do you have any explanation from that, from your sort of a geological or a, let's say an informed point of view?
I think there's two elements to that. One is the investor base, which makes it a little bit more complicated. And the other one is where were the both companies start from. And I think we're all very well aware how Horse Hill was, you know, sold to the market back in the day as the Gatwick Gusher, you know, really, really high rates. And the initial rates, let's be honest, aggregate rates of 1,300 barrels a day, fantastic. You know, that hasn't happened onshore in a long time. But initial rates are usually the highest rates that you start off with. It's very rare that you can produce higher unless you get more access to the reservoir. If you simply use the same zone, then you have natural depletion rates like every oil and gas well has. So having the, you know, assumption that you can outperform your initial rate, it's highly unlikely. And I think that should have been squashed by the company straight away. And you have to look at the long-term economics of this field. So when the results came out yesterday, well, my compliments, absolutely fantastic job for UCOC. And the market might not appreciate fully how good these results are, because if you're looking for 1,000 barrel a day, well, take a step back. What have they actually said? They said, we've produced from one single layer, 10,000 barrels in total over about a month, which equates to about 342 barrels a day. Well, then take a step back, look at the economics. I already told you, this is a it's a hybrid reservoir. So wherever you sink this well, you should be able to replicate this result. This is our hypothesis.
Right. So but I mean, just getting the whole wheel basin thing, I'm because obviously after 5 years, is, you know, this story is going on and on a bit. It look like, can't you say it even at this stage, that whoever's producing there is not going to be producing more than 300-500 barrels a day on a consistent basis, and therefore any oil company there is going to be a small oil company or small to medium oil company, maybe worth $200 or $300 million at the most. It's not going to be the next Shell or BP or anything else like that, is it? Or even Premier Oil.
Well, if you look at it from a single site, then you're correct. At the Horse Hill site, they have room for a couple of wells. So, you know, let's take an arbitrary number. Let's say 10 wells. They produced from this single layer, assume that's the only layer that they will flow from, ignore any other layers that they could potentially produce from in the Kimmeridge. Then those 10 wells, by the time you drill it, someone will have depleted, you'll be producing 1,500 barrels a day from this site. Well, 1,500 barrels a day in the tax regime in the UK, that would already make you, what is it, £250 million company, market cap, single site. But the wheeled companies, and us among them, it's not going to be about a single site. There's many multiple sites that we can regenerate, reuse, and replicate that. So I think the markets can be in excess of that, because right now people are looking at the results of a single well, and in the case of Horsehill, from a single zone, and tying that to the market cap. But you have to look at the future development program in order to come up with your market cap.
So the currently the market cap is 100 million. So it could still be 300-500 million with a fair wind behind it, let's say.
Yeah, but for that, what you also need is you need the structural change in your investment base. What you need to have institutional investors in there, because, like you say, we have a great following from the retail investors, and so does UKOC, for that matter.
Any explanation why the institutions are not in yet? Is it because they want to see more? They're still waiting.
The placing, we got a fully way to institutional investors, so we were very happy that we did the whole placing. With institutional investors, about three quarters of it to you know, the biggest institutional investors in the small and mid-cap space in the UK.
So taking it over to a more macro picture, looking at Brexit, which is obviously massively in the headlines at the moment, how does Brexit affect Angus Energy, and what preparations are you making? Is it an opportunity?
It's indeed... Looking at today and what's happening in the cabinet at the moment, it's indeed a highly volatile time, to put it that way. But no matter what the outcome of this, we have to work in the environment that's given to us. But what is, I think, is very important is energy security. And energy security has been, you know, hasn't received a lot of attention lately. And I think that's very wrong. I think especially for, you know, the geographic location of the UK where it is, energy security should be paramount, should be top of the agenda.
Could you just explain what energy security is for us, Paul?
Energy security means that you, as a country, need to have energy for everything that the country needs, to heat your homes, for transportation, to produce stuff, to have the electricity, to use the internet, for example. You need electricity for anything to make our lives better. And because Great Britain is a collection of islands, there's only a limited amount of imports that you can do at any moment in time. Look at how close we came last year to basically running out of gas. Well, we're not really in the gas business, we're in the oil business. But also within the oil business, there's been no investments to speak of in the whole industry since 2014. So the oil price is now on a slightly downward trend again because of geopolitical issues. But what is completely underestimated by the market is that in order to give that supply to the market by OPEC, as was, you know, asked for by Trump, is that they basically completely eliminated any spare capacity. We now have less spare capacity in the system than we had back in 2008 when the oil price shot to $147 a barrel. There's not a huge amount of investment in the industry happening. So take a look 2-3 years out. Where is the oil coming from? Well, the Americans will use it for themselves. Asia and India will be guzzling it up. Where does that leave, you know, Europe? Where does that leave Britain? I think it's very important for Britain, with a declining, you know, production rate on the North Sea, is that, you know, we look at all different sources of energy. And what's happening in the world can be, you know, a great boon, both financially and also from an energy security point of view to Britain, especially in independent Britain.
Do you think you've been given decent support by the authorities in terms of your journey in the Weald Basin?
We have developed a great relationship with all our regulators, but at this moment in time, you have to be honest, the cabinet has got other worries rather than working at a future a future energy supply. Although I do think with the Horsehill well test, with Balcombe, with us switching on Brockham shortly, that will probably change in the next few months.
So with oil prices and where they are, they're obviously very volatile at the moment. And because you're someone who's got your hands dirty actually working on a well, but you actually also are an analyst and understand the financial implications, what's your outlook for the oil price? Where do you see it going over the next 5 to 10 years?
I think from where we are right now, the only way is up. Because look at it, about a billion and a half people are trying to become, you know, have a middle class lifestyle, which we have enjoyed in Europe and America for the last 50 years. And it's all happening in Asia. So even though we're getting much more, you know, fuel efficient in Europe and America, which is a great thing, and we should really applaud that, what we have is 1.5 billion of new customers, you know, in Asia that want to have the same lifestyle that we've been enjoying. And therefore, that oil needs to come from somewhere. We're right now, I think a few weeks ago, for the first time, we crossed the 100 million barrels of a day usage mark, which is tens of millions of barrels more than it was a few years ago. And that trend...
So it's going up. So people would say that because of solar energy and hydroelectric fuel and all the other alternatives that and also with the government's wanting to reduce our use of petrol in cars, etc., that oil usage would be going down. But you're saying it's actually going up.
In all the plausible scenarios, other than the, you know, we all go live in a cave again scenarios, in all the scenarios, oil usage is going up.
That's fascinating. I wouldn't have expected that to be the case. So let's take a situation where, as the trend is, you do get rid of petrol and diesel cars. How does that affect the oil price?
It's part of a component, you know, electrical cars. Electrical growth cars are great. Look at the current models that they're making. They're actually really cool cars. But that's going to be a very slow process. And even though if that process, you know, accelerates as it should be, what we have is a continued growing demand for liquids, for hydrocarbons, as we're producing worldwide. That is simply going up because it is... Electric cars are great, but they're just a small component of the total usage of oil. We use oil for everything. All the big tankers, aviation, the petrochemical industry. Oil is used for everything, for a whole variety of sources. And we should, as a society, use all the energy, you know, supplies that are available to us. But oil is simply a very large component of that and will be under any scenario for the decades to come.
So presumably, the electricity that we're putting into the electric cars has been created by a power station that's burning oil. Would that be correct?
No, that's not really correct, because there you go into the power business, and power is historically, and especially in the UK, it's gas to limited demand, coal, and then nuclear, and now wind and solar. I think the best description to describe the hydrocarbon and the fossil fuel industry, the oil industry that Eggers Energy is in, is, as a friend of mine said last week, it's a sunset industry, but it's a lovely sunset. So we're talking about decades, and when you look over the lifetime of a company, you know, within the investment time horizon that we're in, you know, in our lifespan, you know, I'm not worried that the demand for oil will evaporate. No, the opposite. I think that the industry as a whole and the world as a whole has really underestimated the lack of investment that's happened in the industry for the last 3-4 years. And looking 2-3 years ahead, the big question is, where is it coming from? Well, we don't have an answer for that. And therefore, I think the upside risk to the oil price is much higher than any near-term downside risk.
Do you think it's possible for us to be completely independent?
I don't think that should be the goal, to be fully energy independent. What you do want to have is flexibility. You want to have choice, because we would be more than happy if our oil is sold and goes to Asia, because the traders that sell our oil, they can get a higher price for it down there. But we should also have the choice that if we want it here and we decide to keep it here, we keep it here.
Well, I just want to touch on the recent fundraise that you got away. I think it was £2 million. And just run us through that and the idea behind and the timing behind that.
Yeah, we looked at our business plan. We've got a few business development ideas we want to discuss with you in the future. We want to switch Brockhamon. We have the funds to switch Brockhamon. But what is also happening is that the Oil and Gas Authority, before they give the final stamp, says, you know, you can go ahead, you can commission it well, you can go ahead. They do a financial, you know, a capacity check. So what we needed is a little bit of fat on the bones. You know, we don't need it, but you know, for any unforeseen circumstance and everything, you've got the fat on the bone. So that is what this placing is ensuring: business development and fat.
Will that see you through to production?
Oh, absolutely! Because the moment we switch Brockhamon, bomb, it's done. We're in production. And then there's
no need for a placing for an extended period. Is that the case? Is that what shareholders should think?
Now, take a step back. As a CEO of a company, you can never say we're not going to do a placing. I might have a wonderful business opportunity for you in the next couple of months. And, you know, we would do that with the placing. So I cannot say to you, oh, we're not going to do a placing. If we leave the company as a status quo, then Brockham Production, you know, would provide all the funds. But I wouldn't like to manage a company, and I wouldn't like to be a shareholder of a company that's just going to sit on the production of a single well or, you know, multiple wells at Brockham and then lay back. They call it a lifestyle company. I would actually want to create additional value for the company.
So yeah, I was leading into actually just say, because the 2 million seemed to be, I mean, it seemed to me, obviously, from a rather armchair observer, you could have raised 3 or 4 million, and the market would have been, you know, reasonably happy with that. So it was just, it was actually, you know, there was demand, there was actually demand for your stock, and still is obviously at that time.
Yeah, no, we were more than happy with the two. We didn't need to raise more.
Just for the layman, you're raising some money because you want to invest in future oil fields. Is that correct?
Business development, we called it. Yes. So there's a few opportunities that we're pursuing that we believe could create quite significant value to the shareholders. Doing due diligence on them and looking at them, they cost money.
Fantastic. Okay. So can you tell us where you see next areas of interest, or is that kind of state secret, so you're not allowed to discuss anything about that?
No, we've always been very clear with our strategy already since the IPO. You know, we're an onshore focused company, and we focus on value development opportunities, appraisal and development opportunities where we can we create value that's been overlooked by other parties. So no, we've been very clear about it, and we have made several acquisitions since our IPO that built on that. They've all been focused onshore UK. What we started out was Brockham and Lidsey. We added an interest in Homewood, which is next door to Brockham. And most importantly, earlier this year, we acquired a 25% stake in Balcombe and became the operator there in July. And in September, we did the well test. And no, that also was another piece in the puzzle of opening up the wheel basin. And that strengthened our theory that it is indeed a hybrid reservoir. And all over that area, you should be able to produce, you know, commercial hydrocarbons.
Yeah, I just wanted to actually just underline that for the point, because you were saying about onshore being much easier than offshore, which obviously it is. What is your sort of rough cost per barrel relative to the oil price?
We have made a statement earlier where we roughly spend $20-$25 a barrel on OPEX and refinery cost and transportation cost. The more we produce, the lower that number gets. The less we produce, you know, the number goes slightly up. But roughly, that is our internal calculation in order to say how much actually costs to get out of the ground.
So at $80 a barrel, you were laughing at even at 60 or 55. You're still chuckling.
Well, let's run through a scenario. Let's tie it into what Horsell announced yesterday. Yeah. So Horsell announced yesterday that they produced from one zone an average of 342 barrels of oil per day. Well, we're in a $67 oil price environment, if I look at the screen. So that would give you roughly 40 barrels of income. That equates to, we own 65% of Brockham. So net to Angus, I'm talking about now, that is $270,000 a month from one well, from one zone in that well. $270,000 a month. That is, if you, you know, do that, if you sustain that rate for 12 months, that's $3.3 million a year. It's about £2.5 million from one zone, from one well. So yeah, I have to be honest, I thought a share price reaction, and I was like, guys, this is really, really a good result. Because one well, one zone, £2.5 million a year in gross income.
Well, I mean, the problem you have is that Manchester United football players earn more than that, so the people are obviously... People are obviously not that impressed.
No, because it is a hybrid reservoir, you should be able to replicate that result in most zones there in that wheel basin.
So, Paul, tell us a bit about how technology has changed through the time that you've been involved in the oil and gas business. So from the days of when you actually got your hands dirty to now, what have been the big developments?
Well, the big developments on the technology side have primarily been around efficiency, because this is not an industry that is now doing things radically different than they were doing them 50 years ago. They've just become much more efficient at it. So for example, with drilling a well that, you know, back when I was working in Northern Africa, would cost them 3 months to drill. With current understanding of geology and drill bits, they can probably drill that same well in about a week and a half, if you have the right drilling equipment. And most of that investment has all taken place in Northern America. Now, if you take a step forward and you look at the UK, what we'd like to do in the future in the UK, we would also like to get those rigs that are more silent, that are more efficient and can drill the wells faster and therefore cheaper into the UK. Right now, we have a lot of, you know, legacy equipment in the UK, but that is going to change into the future. Also, subsurface-wise, I'm a wireline engineer, so I'd made the, you know, I render tools that make the maps that people then use to analyze what is in the ground. And that is exactly what we did at Brockham, because when we drilled the sidetrack of the well that we're going to put into production shortly, the idea was, after the Horsell well test in 2016, it's like, Well, it only could have floated 1,300 barrels a day if it is a fractured reservoir. But no geologist had even contemplated that before that. So we were like, okay, the only way to find out if we actually make like an image, a photograph of the well. So one of the new tools that got developed in the last few years was a sonic tool, makes it like an ultrasound image, and it basically gives you in oil-based mud, you know, oil-based mud, you cannot see anything, but in oil-based mud, it makes the picture of our borehole. So when, after we drilled the well, we now have a beautiful picture, and it's on our website, of all the fractures that are in the Kimmeridge. And therefore, we came to the conclusion, it's like, hey, off that 400-meter Kimmeridge zone, 200 meters of which is naturally fractured. We can see it on the image log. And now what we're going to do when we commission those well, we're going to perforate those fractured zones and flow from all of it. And that is how technology is helping us produce from a layer of oil that historically, for very sound scientific reasons, has been ignored. And now we're looking at it, hey, with this new additional information, it's actually, you know, a very, hopefully very prolific reservoir.
So you've got a, like a 3D ultrasound in terms of the what's underground these days.
Correct, yes.
And so before, they didn't realize that it was there, or they thought it was there, but they didn't think they could get to it. Is that if that's a simplification of it?
The simplification of it is that as soon as you start speaking with a geologist, it becomes much more complex. First of all, they didn't think it was mature enough to generate the oil. Well, we did a lot of research on that, and we found out that there's a very specific reason for it, why the maturity estimates were underestimating it, and it was still maturity means that it's the right temperature and pressure to cook, you know, the organic matter into hydrocarbons. And what we now see is that the vast majority of the Weald Basin has actually been under the right conditions to produce the hydrocarbons, as you saw from, you know, the oil that we produced at Balcom, the sample that we got at Litsi, and, you know, now 342 barrels a day from 40 API oil from a single, you know, horse oil well. So the maturity analysis, that is now covered. That was one reason why it was overlooked. And the other reason why it was overlooked is that the first people that drilled the well there, it's an interbedded limestone, which is a reservoir. That's where, for example, all of Saudi Arabian oil is coming from. It's coming from limestone reservoirs. Interbedded with the claystone, with the shale, which is the source rock, which is where the oil is coming from. And this is all nasty stuff to drill, because if you drill through it, it wants to collapse in itself. If you drill it with water, you get big washouts. It's if you're a driller, it's not easy to drill through. So therefore, people wanted to drill through it fast. And when they looked at the limestone, which could be a potential reservoir under the old analysis, it's a super tight rock, which is completely correct. But because it's fractured, the oil is in the fractures, and that's what the reservoir is. So you have some in the rock itself, and the majority you've got in the fractures. So it's a complex system. So it was easy to overlook, and there were other layers that people were going for.
And so you can take this, presumably, this 3D ultrasound technology and look at other areas in the UK and find similar results.
That is not an unreasonable assumption that you could do that, because if we can do something like this in the Weald Basin, where I've been fully focused, there is, you know, now you need to really speak with geologists, but basically what you need to do is you need to go to some of those old wells, rework them, and see if, you know, those same layers that we have in the Weald are somewhere up north. They might be in the Midlands. But right now, we think the vast majority, and that's where most of our resources are right now going, it's in the Weald. We'll be so busy there that we're not looking up there at the moment. But it's not unreasonable to think that something similar could happen.
Okay, fantastic. Well, Paul, thank you so much for coming on the show. We'd really love to get your view on the oil market in the future. So hopefully we'll have you back on the show in the future.
No, Paul, would love to. Yeah, if you want to have a general industry comment, then happy to join in and give my 2 cents.
That's fantastic. And Zach, as always, thank you so much for your questions, and have a fantastic weekend till the next one. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Paul. It's been great to talk, and I hope you will join us quite soon.
Cheers, guys. Hey, have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too. You too, Paul. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. Please do your own research or contact a professional advisor.